So we open our Bibles to the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 1. You'll find the book of Ecclesiastes immediately following the book of Proverbs. And Proverbs follows the Psalms. And it's in the Old Testament, so. And I certainly hope that what I've got to say this morning will not in any way take away the edge of the truth that our brother's been bringing us from this 32nd Psalm. Sometimes the second speaker has some difficulties that the first one doesn't have, but in the matter of taking a good deal of time, two speakers have a considerable amount of time. I don't want anybody to get sleepy. I was told there was a preacher in the East, pastor one of the churches in the East Coast, who was given a questionnaire as to how many people they could sleep during a time of a disaster, and he says, "I don't really know," but he said every Sunday morning, he said, "We sleep 400 over here." All right, Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 12, verse 13. I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. Of all the men that lived in this world, and of all the men that had understanding and wisdom, the deep perception, able to penetrate into the thinking capacities of his fellow man, able to understand in so many different areas, there was none that could probably equal or come up to this man Solomon. And yet in this particular passage, this man tells us that there was one thing above all the things that he saw in this world that caused him to seek and to search out by wisdom. Why all these things were done, the sore travail that God had given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. Solomon's searched his heart as to how and why God did what he did with men. There's not one person that comes into this world, but sooner or later he comes underneath the dealings of God. And I want to look this morning at the purposes of God in his disciplines with men. His training. What he does when he deals with men. And we're going to be looking mainly in the epistle to the Hebrews, and we'll be looking in the 12th chapter, which you might turn to at this time. Hebrews chapter 12, and for brevity's sake, we will not be reading all of these verses, except as we approach them. But we'll be starting from the third verse. He says, "For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest you be wearied and faint in your mind. You have not yet resisted unto blood striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks unto you as unto children, My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourges every son whom he receiveth." God has no son that he does not discipline. Absolutely none. Every single son and child of God comes underneath the disciplinary action of God. Everyone. Now, God had only one son that was without sin, but he has no sons without suffering. Regeneration prepares one for God's presence. But discipline prepares one for God's purpose. Regeneration requires but one split moment, but discipline requires a lifetime. Regeneration has in view man's conversion, but discipline has in view the saint's character, and God is intensely interested in that, in the development of His children. And one of the major ways that God deals in any believer's life is in what we call discipline. And if you look the word up, you will notice that the root of it is the word child, and it deals mainly with child training. It is used in different ways, in different places, in the Old and the New Testament alike, sometimes referring to chastisement, punishment. Sometimes it's used in connection with nurture, instruction, correction. So there are various shades of meaning attached to it. But basically, it is God's process whereby He deals and trains and prepares His Son. The disciplines of God, as I see them, go out from Him in two different ways. They proceed from God as the Creator to all creatures. They proceed from God as Father to His own sons, as we'll see a little bit later on. Now, the non-Christian may be perfectly oblivious to God's dealings, but oftentimes the believer is ignorant of them. And so, when we think of this particular study, and I know that it is not a kind of study that will make anybody say, well, you'll get an Oscar for that, or even an Emmy. If I were to talk about how to take care of $1 million, possibly there'd only be half of the audience interested in that. Or how to preserve your Mercedes-Benz, there might be only three quarters of you interested in that. But when we're talking about this subject, we're talking about something which affects every single person. Everyone in this audience this morning, whether he's young or old, whether he's a man or a woman, whether he's learned or unlearned, everyone comes underneath this category of God's dealing. And this is the thing that caused Solomon to ponder it. Discipline goes out in four different directions. We might say four different dimensions. The first dimension is its punitive, that is, its punishment. And this is for direct disobedience, penalty for disobedience. The second aspect of it is its corrective. It's to restore the believer to right use, right living. Third, it is instructive, to teach or to enlighten God's people. And last of all, it's objective, to bring a believer to a goal or a complete purpose. This is what we have in. You remember when Elimelech and Naomi went down into Moab many, many years ago. There was a famine in Bethlehem, Judah. And in order to get away from the famine, which was the discipline of God against His people for departure, we find that Elimelech decided that he was going to get away from it. And he took his family, his wife and his two sons, and he immediately dispatched himself to the land of Moab, where he proceeded to live. And the way the scriptures put it, it seems to me that he did not intend to stay there very long, but the years rolled by so that there were 10 years at least. And then something happened. Elimelech died. His two sons died. They had in the meantime acquired Moabite's wife. In this family, we see the disciplines of God, and we see them in all four different directions: punitive, corrective, instructive, and objective. In the case of Elimelech, it was punitive. God had to remove him. His two sons were also taken away. Their lives were short. Elimelech's name means "My God is King." He sure didn't act like it. Now, Naomi was exercised by the dealings of God, and she was corrected. She says, "I'm going to go back. I'm going back. I'm not staying here any longer." And for her, it was a corrective discipline. In the case of Ruth, an outsider, it was instructive. She was involved with this family, but she says, "I'm going to go with you. Your God's going to be my God, and where you die, I'll die, and your people are going to be my people, And for her it was instructive. She says, I'm going to go with you. And you remember the story that when they got back to Bethlehem, Judah, that there was a man that had gone through the disciplines of God over the nation Israel, and his name was Boaz, and mind you, he is called a mighty man of wealth. And how did he amass his wealth? He stayed through the discipline and was exercised by God and came out of it a mighty man of wealth. And Ruth, of course, was linked up with Boaz. And then we have the final phase of God's dealing with this remarkable incident, and that is, it was objective. She became Boaz's wife. Discipline will produce this: instruction, correction, fruitfulness, usefulness, and holiness. All of these things. Now, I want to deal with this as best I can in three or four different areas. The first thing that we want to look at a little more closely this morning is the subjects of discipline. And in order to do that, we've already looked at Ecclesiastes chapter 1, but I want to have you keep that in mind as we go back to the book of Proverbs. And you pick up a verse which I'm sure the writer to the Hebrews uses. In chapter 3 in Proverbs 11, he says, My son, despise not the chastening of the Lord, neither be weary of his correction. For whom the Lord loveth, he correcteth, even as a father the son in whom he delights. So we see the basis for what we have in the Epistle to the Hebrews is founded upon what is taught in Proverbs chapter 3, verse 11. Now let's just compare these two places here. In Ecclesiastes 1, 13, it seems to me that the discipline has to do with those that are outside of the family of God. Solomon in Ecclesiastes views things as they happen under the sun. But in Proverbs, we see him coming closer into the family of God, and he speaks of the son. It's the family. And we find that there is a discipline which is outside of the family circle, and there's a discipline on the inside of the family circle. Now, I am a father, and I am a neighbor, too. And when our children were growing up, we had the neighbor's kids in our yard half of the time. And sometimes they would get into some of the most outrageous things you ever saw. If you only knew how many garage windows I had to replace, how many times something unsightly and unearthly happened out there. And you know what I would do when I'd go out there and hear all these boys staring me in the face? There were my boys and there were the neighbor boys. I'd say a few choice words to the neighbor boys, and then I'd open the gate and I'd say, get out. That's all I did with them. Now, I would like to have done more. But with my boys, it says, boys, I have told you again and again not to play baseball in the backyard. Now, let's come in here, and I'm going to give you something to help you to meditate on that. Now, I would like to have done something like that to the neighbor's boys, but I didn't. Solomon says, I have seen the travail that God has put upon the sons of men. Not the sons of God. Did you know this is the way God has of arousing the sinner to realize that there's a God? He may never put his foot in a place to hear the gospel preached. He may never receive a tract, but he cannot escape the discipline of God. I remember a wheat farmer in western Kansas whom God saved and who gave a very wonderful testimony. And I remember as he gave his testimony, he says, folks, he says, I had no time for God, no interest in the Bible, no time for the gospel. But he says, I lost three wheat crops, one after the other. And finally he says, oh God, what are you trying to do to me? What are you trying to tell me? And then when they had gospel preaching over in the old schoolhouse near Canarado, this man was one of the first to get saved. Solomon says, I've seen the sore travail that God allows to fall upon the sons of men that they may be exercised thereby. We have a young man in Wichita who is at the point of taking his life. He despaired of life. He didn't want to live any longer. He had hit the bottom. He had experienced every wicked thing that he could experience in this world. He says, I'm finished. And on a suicide bed, he turned to God and to Christ. And he was saved. He's in the assembly there too. But when it comes to the family of God, we find that he operates within the circle. And he operates just a little bit differently. Would you notice now, please? In the 22nd Psalm, I would like just to give this a passing glance as we go along. In Psalm 22, you may say, well, how can I tell if God is dealing with me? I'll give you a little clue. Because I'm aware of the fact that God may be dealing with you, He may be dealing with me, and there may be some who are being dealt with and not really aware of it. They may say, well, you know, I've got bad luck. And this thing has happened and that thing has happened, and they don't see God behind the thing at all. But I'll give you a little clue. In Psalm 22, the psalmist says here, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou so far from helping me and the words of my roaring? When a person gets to the place in life under the travail that God allows to fall upon the sons of men and the sons of God, when he gets to the place where he looks up and says, why, then he's in the territory where God's trying to deal with him. When he says why. And David goes on to say, in the following scriptures, he says, oh my God, I cry in the daytime, but you don't hear me. I'm talking, Lord, and you don't hear me. Why? Then in verse 40 he says, our fathers trusted in thee. They trusted and you delivered them, but you're not delivering me, Lord. My enemies are closing in on me. Why? And in verse 60 he says, I am a worm and no man. A reproach of men, a despise of the people. All that see me laugh me to scorn. Lord, what are you doing to me? Why? Have you ever gotten to the place when even those very closely associated with you, unaware of what is taking place in your life, and you cry out, oh God, why? I'm not talking to elderly people today alone. This sort of thing is in the area of the child, the junior high student, the high school student, the college age, the young married couples, the middle age, and the old. Why? What's going on, Lord? What are you trying to tell me? What are you doing? Back in Hebrews again, chapter 12, I notice in verse 5, the first thing, they are sons. He deals with his sons. That's the first thing. It's on the basis of relationship with God that he deals with his own as with sons. That's a very special dealing. The second thing, in verse 6, for whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth. The second characteristic is then, of the subjects, is that they are loved of the Lord. They're sons, they've experienced a birth into the family of God. Now there may be someone here this morning, and you may not know Christ as your personal Savior, but you do know something about the travails of living in this world. You can't live in this world without experiencing them. Every single one of us could tell the story of a travail or two. If you're not a Christian, then God is using that to cause you to look up. God speaketh once, yea, twice in a dream, in the vision of the night, and man perceives it not. But God is always trying to arouse man to look up. I used to preach with Brother Tom so many times, we'd go into the hospital, and Tom didn't have what they call good bedside manners. But I tell you, he got results. Many times we walked into a hospital room, there was somebody sick, whether it be an unsaved person, and Brother Tom would say to him as he held the Bible in his hand, he says, you know, the only time, he says, a hog looks up, he says, when he's going to be butchered. Now, that's not what you generally say when you go into a hospital and see an unsaved person that's very sick. But I've seen many times when he said those words and their eyes would blink and they say, well, you know, you're just about right. God has got to arouse people. Nations have been spoken to by God. Families. God is trying to exercise their hearts. But when he comes to his own, he's operating with love. There's love. Notice the third thing. Verse 7 and 8. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? But if you be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are you bastards, then are you illegitimate, and not sons. So you see, everyone comes underneath the category. There is a within and there's a without. Those that are without the circle of relationship with God are dealt with by the Creator God. Those that have been regenerated are into the family circle and are dealt with as God the Father. They are His sons. They are sons in the family. You know, the Japanese have a saying that there are four great calamities. Calamity number one was fire. The second was a typhoon. The third was earthquake. And the fourth was a father. I don't know whether that would apply to many fathers in this day or not. But you know, the old timers that came across the pond from Europe, I remember as a boy in Chicago that the the parents of foreigners generally had a much stricter form of discipline than we have in the States today. In the States, the children generally rear the parents. And the parents are the product of the children's caprice and discipline. And the old-timers took things into their own hands and they dealt with them. But all are subjects of his discipline. The second thing that I'd like to look at is the attitude toward this discipline. And if you will look now again at the fifth verse, you will find the first attitude that is mentioned here. As God deals, he is met with various attitudes. Now, I noticed that with my own family, but it's very true in the family of God. In verse 5, he says, "And ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaks unto you as unto children, my son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord." The first one is to despise the chastening of God. That is, God may deal with an individual, and this individual may know that God is dealing with him. I'm talking about the child of God, because there are many who know that there is something in their life that ought not to be there, and God is dealing with them, and what do? They despise his dealing. In other words, they grit their teeth and they say, "I will not do it. I just will not do it." Like Jonah, when God says, "Jonah, you go to Nineveh," and Jonah says, "I'll not go. I have looked into the faces of believers, and with my Bible in my hand, and with the very matters openly placed before us, and I was aware of it, and the person I was talking to was aware of it, and God was undoubtedly aware of it. I have had them look me in the eye and say, I will not do it. I will not." And they despise the chastening of God, and it leads to resentment. The second thing is, in the same verse, in verse 5, "Nor faint when thou art rebuked of it." Now, fainting is quite the opposite from despising it. This is where a person just gives up. A person like this may be one who is not completely aware that God is dealing with him. The only thing he's aware of is that everything is going bad. Everything is sour. He's aware that when he tries to do something, it meets to no avail. He accomplishes so little. He's one of these people that seems to be saying, "Well, I'm plagued with bad luck. Everything I do just seems to abort. And what am I going to do? Well, what's the use of being a Christian? I thought when I became a Christian that everything would be different. I thought everything would be better." No, no. You know, God never promised that when you became a Christian that he was going to lighten the load. He didn't say that he was going to take away the thorns. He didn't say he was going to take away the pressures. He simply says that I'm going to be with you. Those men that went into the fiery furnace were not spared from going into the furnace, but they knew the presence of God with them in the affliction. So when a person is not aware of what God is seeking to do in his life and simply sees the adversities and the difficulties, then he is inclined to faint and to give up. And I've seen Christians who, instead of being exercised by what God was doing, they just could not believe that God was doing that or allowing it to happen, and they simply gave up. And they say, "What's the use? Brethren, I have stepped into homes of people who were once in fellowship and going on with God and for God and a blessing for God's people, and today they have given up. And they're not seated in the place to hear the word of God. They're not active anymore. They've given up. They have been hurt. They have been scalded. They have been peeled. They can't understand." And I've seen Christians who, instead of being exercised by what God was doing, they just could not believe that God was doing that or allowing it to happen, and they simply gave up. And they say, what's the use? Brethren, I have stepped into homes of people who were once in fellowship and going on with God and for God and a blessing for God's people, and today they have given up and are not seated in the place to hear the Word of God. They're not active anymore. They've given up. They have been hurt. They have been scalded. They have been peeled. They can't understand. And so they simply give up. That's the second attitude. I feel sorry. I felt sorry, I should say, for Job. Not only for the boils he had and for all that he underwent. I'll tell you, if any man could have given up, I suppose Job could have. But you know, he had a wife that stood there and says, well, Job, curse God and die. I tell you, that was rough. Give up, Job. Give up. Whatever Job's fault may have been, along with all his virtues, Job did not give up. And oh, friend, if I'm talking to one today and your life seems to be so different from everybody else's and the kind of pressures you are in are so extremely different and almost beyond all that you can bear, don't for a minute believe that God has abandoned you. He has not turned His back on you, but may be at the point of bringing you to that place where you will look up into His face and will deal with whatever He's trying to show you in your life and say, Lord, what are you trying to show me? God is not abandoned. Not after listening to what our brother said this morning. God is not going to turn you by. He's going to deal with you. And then in verse 7, he says, if you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. Now sometimes people just carry out the endurance to an extreme point to become a stoic, and they say, well, this is a kind of life for me. You know, I just believe that this is the way it is to be a Christian. You know, I just think that Christians got a rough time all the way through, and I just keep asking God, you know, to, you know, give me a stiff upper lip and help me to live with it, and then when Jesus comes, why then I'll be relieved of all my pressures and everything like that. I don't believe there's any relief until Jesus comes, and they just kind of grit their teeth and say, well, I'm going to do it. They don't despise it. They don't faint. They say, well, this is a kind of life that you have as a Christian. And oh, how many Christians I meet today that are not living in the enjoyment of fellowship with God and through the Lord Jesus. Like someone has said, that to be a Christian seems to be more a matter of enduring salvation than enjoying it. Have you ever seen any like that? You'd think so sometimes. Especially when you look at the prayer meeting in contrast to the Bible hour. And I say, you know, you're asking too much of me. I can't stand any more than one meeting a week. That's just about all I can take then. And then the final thing is, in verse 11, now he says, no chastening for the present seems to be joyous but grievous nevertheless. For the present it seems to be, it's not joyous, it's grievous, but nevertheless afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are, what? Exercised thereby. Solomon said, I have seen the discipline of God, the chastening of God on the sons of men, that they may be exercised thereby. Why? That they may look up and know there's a God in the heaven. But for the believer, he is to be exercised as a son. And he says, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. When was the last time, dear brother, my sister in the Lord, that you got alone with God and had a little inventory review of your life with Him? This is what we need to do. I think this is one of the problems of our day. We live so fast and furious, we don't even take time to really look into our lives. Psalm 119 and verse 67, David said, before I was afflicted, I went astray. I went astray. And then he says a very lovely thing, but now have I kept thy word. Before I was afflicted. The afflictions of the Lord? Ah, yes, David. He could say, yes, they came, I had afflictions, but you know, before the afflictions came, he says, I went astray. I got off the beam. I got away. But he says, you know, I'm back. And he says, now I've kept thy word. There was a man that was exercised thereby. There was a man that God really dealt with. Oh, how He dealt with him. I almost hesitate to refer to the psalm that our brother did, but I'm sure you won't mind if I just step back for a moment to Psalm 32. And noticing in this particular psalm what David said. Now, you know, this was the experience of a believer. This is not the words of a man that knew not God. This is a man that knew God. This is a man that was in relationship with God. And it's kind of scary to think that you can be in relationship with God and do some terrible things. So unlike our God and so unlike our position in His family. And he says here in verse 4, or in verse 3, he says, "When I kept silence, my bones waxed old through my roaring all the day long." Things were getting old. They lost the freshness. Oh, my dear fellow Christians this morning, let me ask you something. Has the freshness of the Christian life and fellowship with God been always what it should be in your life? It hasn't been in mine. And when something comes in that hinders that fellowship and that joy, then there's a drying up process. Dries up. Nothing wrong with the Word of God. Nothing wrong with our God. Nothing wrong with His mercies and His blessings. But there's something wrong in here. I've had Christians tell me, "Well, you know, I just don't get anything out of it anymore." Well, I'll tell you, if you work a jukebox, you got to put something in to get something out. Before you get a Coca-Cola, you got to put something in. There's a lot of people not putting anything into it. We drove along to the meeting place this morning. A wife looked over and saw about 50 young people out there with baseball bats and gloves in their hand. They're all set to get ready for the baseball season. They're going to get out what they put in. What they get is a question, of course. But you see, God allows us to dry up if things are not dealt with in our lives. And then he says in verse 4, he says, "My moisture is turned into the drought of summer." The drying up of the bones and the drying up of the season. And then he says, "I acknowledge my sin unto thee." Take that Agag out and stone him to death. Friends, I don't have to tell people. I don't have to tell my own heart. I know so many times what ought to be dealt with. And it's an act of unbelief. When I come before God, when I have known sin in my life and I don't deal with it, God is not going to deal with me and bless me and warm my heart until I deal with that thing. He says He deals with us as a father. And I'll tell you something, not as a grandfather. I'm a better grandfather than you think. I know how many grandkids we got now. We've got 11. My wife keeps checking me all the time. Sometimes I miss. But we have got 11 of them. And when they come over there, and I tell you, they're not all look like their grandfather's kids. They don't always do a lot of nice things. But you know, we deal with them in a grandmotherly and a grandfatherly way. I don't deal with them exactly like I did with my own. That He deals with us as a father, not a grandfather. I've been in homes, you know, where the grandkids are there, and there's a kid hanging on the chandelier, and the grandfather will say, now, buddy, don't hang there. You know, very, very gentle. Little Susie's sitting at the table before they get there to eat dinner, and she's got her finger in the bowl of butter, and she's going around and around, and she's licking on it, and grandmother says, now, honey, that's grandparents. And I tell you, when my boys reach their finger over to get it into the butter, that's daughter. Father deals with it. And God dealt with David. And David says, "I've acknowledged my sin unto thee, and mine iniquity have I not hid. I've brought it out in the open." What are we trying to do today? We're trying to hide these things. We're trying to go on as though there's nothing wrong. And oh God, can't you see? Oh, friends, how can we allow the softness and the character of this age come into our lives as Christians, where we look at our God as though He's a grandfather God, and He is not a God that deals with sin. And God hates sin just as much today as He ever did. And thank God He loves His own as much as He ever did. And because He loves us, He says, "I'll not allow you to go on in this thing." And David acknowledges sin. And then in verse 8 he says, I will instruct thee and teach thee in the way that thou shalt go. We have a man that's restored and recovered. It yields a peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them that are exercised thereby. And oh, thank God for the lovely songs that came from the lips of David when God had processed him and David had responded to him. Oh, friends, this morning, let's get away from this stereotype kind of Christianity where we're just playing that we're Christians and we're playing that we've got a God up there. He's extremely real. And then let's think a little bit about the methods of discipline. In verse 5 of Hebrews chapter 12, we're introduced to the very first one. It says, you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks unto you as unto children, my son. Despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art what? Rebuked of him. Now, rebuking has to do with what's wrong in my life. Verse 6, he speaks about scourging. Scourging has to do with what's unseemly in my life. Verse 7, it says he deals with us as a father. This is what is necessary in my life. And in verse 9, he speaks of correction. And this has to do with what should be set right in my life. Rebuking, scourging, dealing, correction. Does it sound familiar? First of all, you establish guidelines in your home. You teach your little tots, well, now here's a no-no and here's an okay. You can do this, you can't do that. One of the first things I taught my children, every one of them, bless their hearts, I taught them, I don't care what you do in the house, kid, but you do not bother Daddy's books. You know, I could be two rooms away from him and one of the kids would be putting his hand up in one of the books and say, eh, eh. That's all. I must preserve my book. I didn't worry so much about the pots and pans in the kitchen, but I sure was concerned about my book. But we had to establish what was right and what was wrong. And then when they knew what was right and they knew it was wrong, then if they did something that was displeasing and they did it in a disobedient, purposeful, willful way, that was a rebuke. Didn't take them out and whip them every time. A rebuke. Rebuked them rather strongly. We had some friends over last week and the little fellow went out to the rock garden and he promptly pulled off the heads of several flowers and the father says, I'm going to spank you. I said, well, far be it for me to tell you not to spank the child, but I said, I don't think that little fella knew that he wasn't supposed to pick them. Maybe, I don't know whether he got flowers at home or not. I don't think they do. But I said, I think you ought to let him know first that he's not to pick them. He said, well, he said, okay. God makes it clear what he expects and what he frowns on. But if we deliberately choose our way in preference to his, then God has his ways of rebuking. He rebuked some of his prophets, some of his servants that took things into their own hands. Then there's the scourging. What's unseemly in my life? There's something there now, it's got to be removed. I remember as a boy we had quite a young bunch of young fellows in the assembly and one of them was in a very bad accident. Broken his leg several different places and we all went to see him and as we were going out of the room and we left the room and we thought, isn't it too bad that Al's lying there with that leg broken so badly in so many places? We don't know why. As we file out of the room, I felt a hand reach out and grab me by the wrist and pull me back in and Al looked at me and the tears was on his cheeks. He says, Len, he says, I know why I'm here. I said, what do you mean, Al? He says, Len, I know why I'm here. He says, I believe God allowed my leg to be broken like this. I know why I'm here. And the tears slid down his cheeks. And Al Valentine had a talk with God. It was beyond the rebuking. He heard the rebuking when he sat under the sound of the word, but it got to the place where it was scourging. And he says, I know. I know why I'm here. Then there's the dealing. What's necessary in my life. You know, God does not deal with every one of us the same way. We are all sons in the family. We're all in the same family with the same father, but he does not deal with us all the same way. I don't know how many children Mrs. Wesley had. I think she had 12. I don't know. I never really was around to count them, but I think she had 12. But they were all exceptional children. The mother of was it John Wesley or Charles? And one day a lady came over and she says, "Mrs. Wesley, you had such a unique family." She says, "All of your children are so well behaved. Would you please tell me what the secret is of how you raised these 12? Could you tell me the secret?" And Mrs. Wesley said, "I don't have one way to raise my 12 children." She says, "I have 12 ways. 12 ways. 12 different children, all requiring 12 different ways of dealing. You can't deal with them all the same way. We had 4 boys and 1 girl. I couldn't deal with any of the boys the same way. I thought when the first one came along, now I've got it made. I'll know exactly how to deal with that boy, Robert. I'll know how to deal with Curtis. I'll know how to deal with Gary. But I found out that every one of these youngsters had a special personality, a special mind and will, and they all required 4 different ways to be dealt with. For example, you could give Danny a paddling, and he was ready to call it quits. Okay, Dad, I'm finished. Robert, 2 whippings every time. 1 for the crime and then 1 for yelling so loud after I whipped him. I knew that he was not yelling that loud because of whipping number 1. He screamed the awfulest screams you have ever heard in your... I don't care how many kids you've had. You have never heard anybody scream like he. And when he let out that unearthly screaming, I gave him promptly his 2nd whipping, and then he was happy. He would stop crying and he'd wipe his eyes and he'd put a smile on his face. He'd go out the door as happy as a king, but he never was satisfied till he got 2. Curtis was different. All he had to do was just give him the eye, like Ray said. And you know, Curtis would just, he'd come to attention. God deals with each one of us in a different way, but he deals. And then, of course, there's the correction, the instruction, the setting right. You know, no kid likes to be dealt with. The writer here says that no chastening seems at the present to be joyous. But he says afterwards. You know, when my parents left this old world, and I told this to kids when we have our children's meeting, and the last thing they did when they closed that lid, just as they brought that lid down, I looked at my mother's old hands. And you know, I'll never hold it against my mother and my father for the way they disciplined me. I wouldn't tell anybody to discipline the kids like they did. My dad used a gas hose, a length about that long, and when I got a whipping with that, I generally went to bed. And I laid there in bed, and I'd run my fingers over those welts, and I'd vow, I said, when morning comes, I'm going to leave this place, and I am not coming back. But I will eat breakfast first. And I had a good breakfast, and I thought, I just wish my mother would just look at me like she did last night. But she'd say, "Anything else I can get you?" And I thought, well, I'll give her another chance. And I never did run away. They whipped me pretty hard, but I don't hold it against them. My father was an old country person, and he had his standard and his ideals, and he taught me some things that I have not forgotten. And I realize now that while he did it, like it says here in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 10, they did it after their own pleasure. When he couldn't stand me any longer and I just galled into him, he just lost his temper and lit in on me. God never administers anything in a believer's life but it's in perfect love. He does it because he wants to bring us into conformity with his will, with his plan. But oh, how we resent it. And I'm going to tell you something. I wouldn't be on an Olympic team as a runner even in my prime, but I was a pretty good runner. In our home in Chicago, we had a round table in the dining room. And all the chairs were put up against the wall. We never had them around the table or up against the wall, and the table was round. And whenever I got into trouble, which was quite often, my mother would light in after me. And she grabbed that gas hose, and she'd take in after me, and I was going around that table. And then, you know, my mother was pretty crafty. She'd throw it in reverse, you know, in reverse direction, and I'd meet her head on, you know, and well, I'd reverse and go around the other way. And every so often, that old gas hose would nip me, you know where. and just put a little extra premium gas in my tank, and I'd really go. And finally, she'd catch me. And when she got me, she worked me over. I found out that it doesn't hurt nearly so much when I bore in real close and I grab her around the knee like a football player. And she'd be trying to get me, you know, but sometimes in hitting me, she hit herself and she had to ease up. I found out when I tried to get away from her, it hurt a lot worse. And I got in real close. And I want to tell you today, if God has been dealing with you in your life, don't try to run away. Don't try to get away from him. But come in real close. Throw your arms around him. You'll find out that he'll do you good because he loves you. The last thing in closing this is that the purpose of discipline that produces it gives the saint a sense of God's person, reverence. In verse 9, it produces subjection to God, as we have in verse 9, and also sustains life, we have in verse 9. Three things. It produces respect for God. You know, kids don't respect parents that don't discipline them. Did you know that? Have you ever noticed that? That a mother and father that allows their children to do anything they want, that those children do not respect them? They will despise them. I've seen it so many times. God loves us. He produces respect. Verse 10, it produces profit. And in verse 10 also, that we might share his holiness in a practical way. And it produces the fruit of righteousness. He teaches us. And the dangers of discipline ignored is in verse 12, discouragement. Wherefore lift up the hands which hang down on the feeble knees. Deformity in verse 13. Make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. There's others looking on. Mother, fathers, husbands and wives, how are we responding under God's dealing with us? There's others looking on. Verse 14. Follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. Looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and therefore many be defiled. Others would be defiled. And there's disappointment, as we see in the case of Esau. What a man he was. You know, Esau sold his birthright, but he wanted the blessing. Why did Esau sell his birthright? Because he didn't want the responsibility attached to it. He wanted the easy way out, but he wanted the blessing. And he sought it with tears. A man with a disappointing life. I'm so thankful today that we've got a father and not a grandfather. We've got one that loves. And he's doing things in our life. And wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if in this conference, some way, somehow, God is going to deal with us through his word so that we will face up the things that need to be put right in our lives and things that need to be put right between our brethren, either if it be a husband and wife or parents with their children or children with their parents. I had meetings in North Dakota one time, and I was amazed. At the close of the meeting, a young man came up to me and literally grabbed me by the wrist and pulled me into the corner of the room, and with the tears coursing down his cheeks, he said to me, he said, "I'm a Christian and my father is a minister here in Valley City. But," he says, "I don't know why it is, but," he says, "just as soon as my father gets around me," he says, I get into an argument with him," and he says, "I curse him." And he says, "I am a Christian, and my father is a Christian, and I curse my father. And I've tried to stop," and he says, "I can't." He says, "What's happening to me?" A most unusual kind of thing, to say the least. And I said, "Well, when you confess your sin to God," I says, "how do you do it?" He says, "I tell God I'm sorry for the way I was that day." But he says, "it doesn't work. It doesn't work.
I said, "My friend, I'm going to ask you to do something. I'm going to ask you to repeat to God what you call your Father." And that young man's face turned red. He says, "Oh, I couldn't do that to God.